Okay, so welcome to the Geometry, Topology, and Physics Seminar. As the blurb that I distributed said, what we're going to try to do this quarter is to focus on a particular topic, namely three manifolds, Ricci flow, and possible applications to and from physics, which is related to the work of recent non-Fields medalist Gregory Perlman. Maybe the only... Well, the only person who deserves to call himself a non-Fields medalist, I guess. The rest of us are non-Fields medalists sort of by accident, but he's not. So what's it about? It's about, on the one hand, some results in topology, the topological classification of compact three manifolds. And that... development in topology, well, it started in a way by Poincaré's declaration about 100 years ago that he knew how to topologically classify three spheres. But this topological classification of compact three manifolds really got underway in the late 70s when Bill Thurston formulated a very precise conjecture about what the structure for compact three manifolds ought to be. That conjecture was based on a lot of important work in three manifolds from before that, but it wasn't really until Thurston's conjecture that we had a very clear statement of what to expect for a general compact three manifold topologically. On the other hand, it's about Ricci flow, so I'll say what that is in a minute. So Ricci flow defines paths in the space of all metrics on a three manifold, or on a manifold, on an n manifold. So I guess here the name is Thurston. Here the introduction of these techniques to study questions of this kind is due to Richard Hamilton in the early 1980s. And Hamilton's idea was that you could possibly get a handle on this topological classification of compact three manifolds by studying a not just a single Riemannian metric on a three manifold, but actually a family of Riemannian metrics, where the way that the family evolves with respect to the parameter is determined by a very simple equation. So the equation is, I'll call the parameter t, although please don't be misled to think that it has anything to do with time. We're talking, for the physicists in the audience, we're talking about compact free manifolds in Euclidean signature only, and this is an auxiliary flow parameter. It's not a time. But anyway, I'll call it t anyway. So the evolution equation, which Hamilton introduced, looks like this. One of the fundamental properties of any Riemannian metric is its Ricci curvature, which is a tensor, a two-tensor, of the same formal kind as the metric itself. So, just to be clear, let me put the T here as well. The flow which Hamilton suggested studying was for a one-parameter family of metrics, says that the metric should evolve in such a way that its derivative with respect to the flow parameter is minus two times the Ricci curvature. The 2 is inessential. It's a choice that he happened to have made. The minus sign is really crucial. What Hamilton showed was that there exist local solutions, short-time solutions to this equation for any compact manifold, I think in any dimension, if I recall correctly. Only if that sign is true would there exist local solutions. If you reverse the sign, there don't exist solutions at all. So the equation is, in many ways, a nonlinear version of a heat equation. And the qualitative feature of the solution is that the solution is dispersive, just like the heat equation solutions are. And in particular, what tends to happen is if you have a non-uniformity to the curvature of the Riemannian metric, the curvature kind of spreads out over the manifold. That's the kind of rough intuitive picture of what solutions to this thing look like. So you might start out with a manifold that's highly curved in some place, and then, you know, sort of very slowly curving in another place, and then those highly curved places are supposed to kind of smooth out in some sense. So Hamilton outlined a program by which Ricci flow, or actually some modification of Ricci flow to invoke one of the topological aspects, ought to yield a proof of Thurston's conjecture. The program kind of stalled until the work of Perelman. So there's a reformulation, among other things, of Ricci flow as a gradient flow. Which was one of Perelman's big contributions. And I just want to discuss that briefly. So I want to discuss it briefly, but I don't want it to look too technical. So what Perelman does is he introduces a functional on the space of all metrics. So if we'd like to understand a flow equation, so this is some horrible, huge space, right? Infinite dimensional space of metrics. And we're trying to follow flow paths along this thing according to some differential equation. Now, if we had a function f with the property that its gradients were being followed by these flow paths, then we might hope to use properties of that function to have better control over the behavior of the flow. Although this could be done for the original Ricci flow, the function that was obtained didn't have such great properties. But one of the sort of key innovations that Perelman made was a reformulation of the Ricci flow problem. So he considers the following kind of functional on the space of all Riemannian metrics, pairs of Riemannian metrics together with smooth functions, where f is a smooth function on the manifold. I guess I haven't given the manifold a name. Let's call it M. Oh, sorry, there it is, M. So R is now the scalar curvature. I'll remind you what these various kinds of curvature are a little bit later. R is the scalar curvature. I just take the covariant derivative, the gradient of the function with respect to the metric, norm square with respect to the metric, e to the minus f dv, and look at this functional. So let's do a little variation of this function as we vary both the metric and the function little f. So vij here is supposed to be a variation of gij, and h is supposed to be a variation of the function f. And in my formula, I'm about to have a quantity which is the contraction of vij using the metric gij. So the variational formula, pardon? H is delta f, thank you. So the variational formula, which Perelman writes down. By the way, on the website for the seminar, there's going to be an audio recording, if this device works, of today's talk, together with notes that are being produced by my friendly volunteers in the second row, together with a list of references. Perelman's original paper is posted on the archive, and that's the only place it's published. Math.dg. His first paper is math.dg 0211159. But there will be a much more complete list of references, mainly to kind of expository accounts of this circle of ideas. So let's see. So it's some long formula. And rather than write out the intermediate step, let me just write out the final step. So he gets a term, an expression for the variation, which looks like this. Vij times Rij plus the derivatives of f in the I and j directions plus v over 2 minus h times twice the Laplacian of f minus the gradient of f squared plus the scalar curvature. And he notes that if dm, which is e to the f dv, e to the minus f dv, is held fixed in this equation, then v over 2 has to equal h with the normalizations that he's using. So Perlman's reformulation of the Ricci flow is to fix that m, fix dm, this measure, set f to be maybe minus the log of dv divided by dm. Dm divided by dv? Sorry. Oh, I should have said long ago, I'm not an expert in any of these things. I meant to say at the very beginning of the talk that part of the motivation for this seminar came from a lecture, that an informal lecture that Dennis Sullivan gave at the Simons Workshop at SUNY Stony Brook in August, which happened just after the Fields Medal ceremony. And he was explaining to a mixed group of mathematicians and physicists what the broad outlines of this story looked like. There was some subsequent discussion among several people, largely Martin Rocek and myself, about possible interesting applications. And that sort of prompted the idea for this seminar. So what I'm aiming for is, by the end, I mean, I'm sort of doing a lot more detail than he did, but by the end of my kind of introductory talk or two in this seminar, I'm aiming to reproduce what Sullivan told us about what Ricci flow on three manifolds should be like now that Perlman's results have been established.
So I think that's backwards from this one. That dm is e to the minus f dv.
There's a minus sign someplace? Minus log? Ah, yeah. Fine. Thank you. Although I was hunting for it in the notes and didn't see it. But it doesn't matter whether I got it right or not, since we've got... Yeah. Thanks. So if we fix dm and we treat f as being determined by essentially by the metric, right? You determine the volume form of the metric, it's some multiple of the fixed background measure, and that tells you a function defined on the manifold. Then you get this functional, fm, just to label the measure, which is the one that we've been talking about, the integral of r plus grad f squared, dm now, it's just the measure. And the gradient flow for this is just a slight modification of the Ricci flow. So it says that the partial with respect to t of gij should be minus 2 times rij plus the derivatives in the i and j direction of f. Well, what f is doing is it's serving as a conformal factor in the metric, and it can be undone by a diffeomorphism. So it turns out that modulo diffeomorphism this is exactly Ricci flow. In other words, it's kind of hard to control the behavior of the space of all possible metrics modulo diffeomorphism. That's an infinite dimensional space modded out by an infinite dimensional group. And what we're doing here is modifying the original problem a little bit so that in terms of the actual metric that's being discussed, the path has changed a bit. But it's changing in such a way that that change can be undone by diffeomorphism. And so the sort of geometric solution to the problem is still the same. So it's no longer true. So there is only existence. Let me phrase that better. Existence of solutions is not always guaranteed. Depends on f or m. Depends on dm. But if they exist, the solution itself is independent of DM up to diffeomorphism. And the advantage of this formulation is that a lot of the technical problems that Hamilton was running into in studying Ricci flow directly are gotten rid of by the added flexibility of this function f. Okay, so let me pause and mention the original appearance of...
Before you leave,
yes.
So you didn't quite come out with Ricci flow because you have this additional function on the right side?
That's right.
Can you comment on why this is any good?
Why?
What's the use for what you have that function there?
So by choosing the function appropriately, this turns out to have better analytic properties than the original Ricci flow. It's sort of Perlman's starting point is to.
But does this mean that it isn't exactly true that Ricci flow is expressed as gradient of function? Is this thing instead?
Ricci flow up to diffeomorphism is being expressed as the gradient of a function, but not exactly the Ricci flow on the...
You're saying that up to diffeomorphism, f can be made constant?
That's right. That's what he's saying. So let me mention the initial connection with physics. So in physics, one wants to study quantum field theories. Two-dimensional quantum field theories, say, with arbitrary, based on arbitrary Riemannian manifolds. What you do is you take your manifold M and your Riemannian metric GIJ, and you look at all the possible maps, and we can talk about what smoothness conditions are appropriate for all the possible maps, all the possible maps from sigma into M, and you weight those maps according to some functional on sigma, a key part of which is the pullback of the metric from the Riemannian manifold. So this is, roughly speaking, action for the map phi. And in quantum field theory, one then integrates formally over these huge spaces. Things of the form e to the minus action, often with some other kinds of functions of phi inserted to learn physical things, times some d phi, where the measure d phi on this mapping space is very hard to define, and it's certainly hard to define if you're trying to make a mathematician happy about the situation. But these are the rough kinds of things which are studied. Now, it's understood by people, so this approach to studying a certain class of two-dimensional quantum field theories really goes back to the early work on the subject of Dan Friedan, the subject of his Berkeley thesis from the late 70s or early 80s, maybe it's 1981, if I recall correctly. And in Friedan's original analysis of this situation, he recognized that for such two-dimensional quantum field theories, so how do physicists study them? They study them by various kinds of approximation schemes, and one of the things which they want to know is how it depends on the distance scale at which they're trying to study the theory, and there's a kind of scale invariance question which goes into the formulation of what's called renormalization for the theory. So, roughly speaking, if you try to formulate these quantum field theories in a kind of naive way, then they diverge, you get a divergent integral. Well, even if you formulate it in a non-naive way, you probably get a divergent integral. But so you make approximations to it that depend on some kind of scale parameter, and you study the behavior as that scale parameter goes to infinity or zero, depending on how you formulated things, and you try to correct for the leading order divergence by this process called renormalization. So understanding how the integrand behaves with respect to rescaling is very important. And the calculation which Friedan made was that the renormalization of this particular two-dimensional quantum field theory is classically governed by this same Ricci flow equation. So what's the idea of renormalization? The idea is that somehow to correct for the divergence, you ought to consider families of integrands or families of functionals which depended somehow on scale, and you manufacture those families in such a way that the thing which is about to be diverging as a function of t is corrected for by changing the family according to the scale. So that's the Wilsonian approach to renormalization, to redefine the quantities that are appearing in the integrand as a function of some kind of scale. And so Friedan was led to write down the very same Ricci flow equation, I think not with that name, I didn't actually go back and look at Friedan's work, as the what physicists would call classical or maybe semi-classical description of renormalization in this context. Let me make one little comment. I'm going to attempt in this lecture to avoid the term renormalization group. Renormalization is actually defines a semigroup, not a group, and that's a fact that physicists don't want to hear about. But mathematicians, when they hear renormalization group, say, well, how do you go backwards? And that's something physicists say is ridiculous because you wouldn't ever go backwards. So just to avoid the issue, I'm going to say renormalization instead of renormalization group.
Well, what does scale refer to in this situation?
Well, so so I hid some things. I hid lots of things. The integrand depends on a metric on sigma as well as on the target space M, and essentially it refers to scaling on the metric of the metric on sigma. My notation hid that fact, but actually I have to do something like this to make sense of the metric.
I thought I understood until you answered the question. Is a Ricci flow on sigma or Ricci flow on M?
It's Ricci flow on M,
yeah,
right. and the Ricci flow on M affects the. So to correct for the scale effects on sigma, you change the metric on M, right? And if you've evolved the metric according to this equation, then that change sort of that cancels out the effects of rescaling on sigma. So you do the rescaling on sigma, and then you correct for that by evolving the metric on M. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Calabi-Yau manifolds had, in principle, shown up as solutions to supergravity theories before Friedan's work. However, when they initially showed up, Gary, you know the story better than I do, the physics community believed that there were no such manifolds, right? Wasn't it true that other than K3. I mean, somehow I thought that it was only K3 that you believed existed until, not you personally.
Well, I mean, Yao's theorem, right, was proven long, late 70s or something.
Yeah, mid-70s.
It wasn't understood the whole significance of that map development wasn't appreciated in the physics community. I mean, so in 1985 or something, we wrote down this Clavial paper, it was, it was the connection with low energy supersymmetry, some physics condition that we wanted in some four-dimensional effective theory, led to conditions on the internal space, which was precisely these.
Right. So Mike, there are actually two places where Ricci flat comes in as a condition. One is here, if you want a no-scale model, something which didn't have the scale dependence, then you might hope that the Ricci tensor completely vanished. But there's a completely independent derivation of Ricci flat as the right condition from the supergravity point of view, trying to reduce a 10-dimensional theory down to 4 dimensions and ask for supersymmetry to be preserved in the theory. And it's really remarkable that it's the same mathematical condition that arises in both contexts. Steve, did you have something to say? Okay, where's my outline? So, as I understand it, Hamilton originally got interested in this problem in the case of dimension m equals 2, although he didn't manage to prove the theorems about dimension m equals 2 until after he had proved some interesting theorems in dimension 3. But let me start with the dimension m equals 2 case. So this was work of Hamilton from the mid-80s. Before I say that, let me make one remark which is independent of dimension, which is that the... I promised you a little review of what all the curvatures were. Okay, so now I'm at a second level interrupt here. So here's what curvature is. So anytime I have a Riemannian metric, it defines in a natural way a pairing which takes tangent vector fields, tensor tangent vector fields, to other tangent vector fields. And usually the way this pairing is written is you take the vector derivative in direction x of the vector field y, giving you a vector field z. So x, y, and z are all vector fields. What that notation disguises is that this is symmetric. So that's the same thing as taking the vector derivative in the direction y of the vector field x. Now the way that you end up with curvature is by considering two such guys. So now I'm thinking of these vector derivatives as giving me a map from tangent vector fields to tangent vector fields. And I can ask whether it's true that those operators on tangent vector fields commute or not. In general, they don't commute. Well, one reason they don't commute is because there's a commutator for the vector fields, which might be non-zero. And so you should worry about that. But that turns out not to... completely solve the problem. And so maybe the first part of the curvature, which maybe can get called RxY, is this complicated looking map from vector fields to vector fields that you get out of these differentiation operators, trying to determine if they commute or not. The actual Riemannian curvature, by the way, I'm doing this in an index-free way, as you may be noticing. There are two kinds of people in the world, people who love indices and people who hate them. So what do? You take RxY, you apply it to Z, and using the metric, you pair that vector field with a vector field W. So that's a function of four variables. And it's anti-symmetric, it's skew-symmetric, in both the XY and the ZW pairs. And then if you switch the XY with the ZW, it's symmetric. So that's the usual four-index Riemann curvature tensor. To get the Ricci tensor, you contract the middle variables. So you contract the y against the z. So I guess maybe now I will use indices. So if I used some kind of orthonormal basis at a point, the Ricci tensor of EI and EJ would mean the sum from k equals 1 to the dimension of this Riemann tensor EI, EK, EK, EJ, something like that. So it contains part of the information about the curvature, but not all the information about the curvature. And then there's the scalar curvature, which is the contraction of the Ricci tensor. Which is just a scalar function varying over the manifold. So those are the kinds of ingredients, and again, the only sort of natural thing to have used in trying to vary the original Riemannian metric GIJ was something that has the same tensor structure, and the Ricci tensor is symmetric in the two remaining indices. It has that tensor structure. Pardon? I'm sorry. Thank you. Well, if GIJ of T is evolving by Ricci flow, I know I introduced this nice gradient flow, but now I'm going to ignore it for a while. If this is evolving by Ricci flow, then the scalar curvature also satisfies an equation. It's the Laplacian of R plus, I think there's a 2 there, R squared. So this is just, so this that's this Laplacian on the manifold M, right? So this is just a nonlinear form of the heat equation. This analogy is better than the previous one. I mean, I said that Ricci flow itself was like a version of the heat equation. Here, I just have a function on the manifold, and if I didn't have this term, it really would be the heat equation. And so it's something like the heat equation. This is some kind of higher order, at least if R is small and varying slowly, it's a higher order perturbation of the standard heat equation. And it kind of explains why we're seeing heat equation type behavior in solutions to this problem. Okay, so in dimension 2, the scalar curvature is really it. Turns out that the Ricci tensor is just R times GIJ. And I'm really reduced to solving something that looks like a nonlinear version of the heat equation. And let me say what the technical problem is. The technical problem is some surface, nice surface, with an initial metric which has regions of both positive and negative curvature. So the regions of positive curvature are going to tend to shrink, and the regions of negative curvature are going to tend to grow. That's sort of immediate from an equation like this. But what's not clear is whether that shrinking and growing can happen in some nice uniform way, kind of leading to a very uniform distribution of curvature or not. But this is something which Hamilton eventually proved. And I guess maybe there were contributions from other people like Ben Chow at the end of the story. So Hamilton, B. Chow, maybe there's some other people who helped finish it up in the negative order characteristic case.
So this is true in whatever genus is greater than 1.
It's true. I'll say what the statement is in general, but it's true for every genus. So given a Riemannian metric on a compact surface, let's consider the rescale Ricci flow So what I mean by that is instead of just minus 2 Rij, I'm going to put the volume in some way. Maybe it's just... Excuse me. Oops. One of these nice screens has it. Yeah, maybe it's just minus Gij. There might be a factor here. There's a curvature factor here. Sorry, minus R times Gij. Well, but I told you Rij.
No, it's a plus.
It's plus?
It's traceless Ricci, isn't it?
It's average Ricci divided by dimension.
Yeah, I'm in dimension 2.
So that's R bar divided by 2.
Okay.
Multiplied by 2. 2 is gamma. So it's just R bar. It's average scalar.
Okay. Yeah, the average scalar curvature. Yes, thanks. So what's the difference between the regular Ricci flow and the rescaled one? This one is concocted to have constant volume. And maybe the time interval along which the deformation is happening is also modified by this additional term. So by changing the time parameter and dividing by the volume, you can go from a family of metrics obeying Ricci flow to a family obeying rescaled Ricci flow, and vice versa. I'll have something to say about that in a moment. So consider rescaled Ricci flow. It exists for all time. And the t goes to infinity limit is a metric of constant curvature. So what actually happens to the Ricci flow, so in the non-rescaled case, if the genus is 0, the volume goes to 0 in finite time. So the Ricci flow actually develops a singularity by any measure of that term at that place where the volume has gone to 0. We'll have to discuss that a bit. If genus is equal to 1, then it the volume stays finite. And if the genus is bigger than 1, then the volume is going to infinity. So the scaling was to let us see what the essential property of the metric was, but if you also take into account the volume, you see this growth or shrinking behavior, which was obvious from the evolution of the scalar curvature. So the hard thing is, if you've got regions of plus and minus, to make sure that the thing stays under control until such time as the sine of the curvature becomes uniform, right? And that turns out to be a tricky thing analytically to control. So Hamilton,
I just have an elementary question.
Sure.
About the sine convention, is the sphere negatively curved from these conventions, the two sphere? Because it seems like the minus sign in front of the Ricci term in the original equation you wrote would imply that. I think that might be what's going on. I mean, we don't want to.
The other problem is that I've used several different references, and they could well have different sign conventions.
So you see what's bothering
me? I absolutely see what's bothering me.
The sphere has a positive curvature.
Yeah. Well, that's the usual convention. But
yeah,
well,
that's the one I use.
But if a sphere is shrinking to a point in finite time, then it's the derivative of the Ricci curvature should be positive, not negative.
Yes, that's exactly why. That's why it shrinks. So the rate of change is negative. That tells you the matrix shrinking. The volume, for example, is going down. So you need a negative rate. If the radius
with this minus,
would expand. So the signs are correct.
Oh, the signs are okay. Okay, thanks.
So, in fact, all that's happening is a conformal rescaling. The entire Ricci flow here just takes the original metric and modifies it by some conformal factor that depends on t. And so the constant curvature metric that you get is the one that was known since the 19th century to exist. There's a unique constant curvature metric in any conformal class of metrics on a compact surface. So there's this classical theorem. The conformal class of any metric on a compact surface has a unique constant curvature representative. If you normalize the volume, if you change the volume of it overall, you can guarantee that the curvature be, you know, plus 1 or minus 1, which is the way this theorem is often stated, but in fact you can do it with a volume present as well. So let me remind you the classification of surfaces which this classical theorem is closely related to, and then I'll start to tell you a little bit about classification of threefolds that's related to that, three manifolds. Three folds usually means, for me, complex three folds. I could give you hours of lectures about the classification of those also, but not today. So remember what this implies. What this implies is that M has a nice form of X mod gamma, where X is a simply connected surface, no longer necessarily compact, with a constant curvature metric. And there are three of those. So X can be the two-sphere, it can be R2 with a flat metric, or it can be the hyperbolic two-dimensional space, the Poincaré disk. Now, each of those is geometric in the sense introduced by Felix Klein toward the end of the 19th century. It takes the form of a group of isometries, so it has a transitive group of isometries in particular, and it takes the form of a group of isometries modulo some subgroup H. And I've written this quotient on the left because I want to be able to take the discrete quotient from the right. But anyway, this G should be the group of isometries of X. And most Riemannian manifolds don't have that structure because they don't have a transitive group of isometries. But anytime you have a transitive group of isometries, you're guaranteed to have this kind of geometric structure. So there are three geometries in dimension 2, maybe the accurate statement, if I remember correctly, is that there are three geometries which admit compact quotients in dimension 2, and these are the three. The trichotomy here shows up in lots of different ways. The compact quotient shows up, we can sort of tell right away by looking at the Euler characteristic of M. So the Euler characteristic of M is negative in this case, 0 in this case, and it's positive in that case. It's an easy way to tell the difference among those guys.
Gamma
automatically as isometries, I've taken a constant curvature metric on M, and when I lift that to the universal cover, I automatically get a constant curvature metric with a discrete group of isometries as the description. Right? So,
so you're starting with a constant curvature case.
These are all constant curvature.
And the M you're talking about is constant.
M is constant curvature, right. Yeah, it's my constant curvature representation.
It's X is the simply connected examples and everything else.
X are the simply connected, and then I'm taking compact quotients of those. X and M both have constant curvature. The constant curvature of X, if you like, is inherited from that of M, right, when I take the universal cover. So, Thurston made an analogous classification of geometries, geometric structures that can occur on three manifolds. So again, M is, I'm not going to assume constant curvature this time, I'm going to assume M takes the form X mod gamma, where M is compact, it's a compact three manifold, and X has a geometric structure. So if I had insisted on constant curvature, I would have got a short list, but it turns out, as Thurston convinced many of us in the late 70s, that it's really useful to consider this more general class where you allow more arbitrary x's. So G, again, is supposed to be the isometry group of x, which acts transitively. This guy has a natural group invariant metric, and we want to study possible manifolds like this. Now, in fact, for the study, more generally, one can look at quotients of the form X mod gamma such that the volume of X mod gamma is finite. And that turns out to be a more general class than asking for the manifold to be compact. And even though one is starting with the problem of classifying compact three manifolds, in fact, those finite volume non-compact quotients play an important role in Thurston's description. So what are they? Thurston found that there are eight geometries. I mean, how are you supposed to remember a list of eight things, right? The eight things, you know, they have some similarities and some differences, and I have to say, I mean, I've looked at this subject a few times over the intervening 30-some-odd years, and every time I kind of forget what some of the geometries are. But this time, I have a sort of better handle on what the geometries are. So one of the key observations is that six of these geometries have circle fibrations. In other words, if M is one of those, if M is X mod gamma for X one of those six types, then M itself has some map to some two-dimensional surface whose fibers are circles. Now, these aren't quite fibrations. They're what are called Seifert fibrations because of the following phenomenon. If I model a piece of surface locally with a complex coordinate and I take a circle bundle over that a trivial circle bundle over that little unit disk, then I can act by a root of unity on the complex coordinate and at the same time translate by that same angle in the circular direction. So if I do that, I get a fixed point free action on the total space of the circle bundle, but what it does on the central fiber is different from what it does on all the nearby fibers. On the central fiber, it wraps around n times, so the quotient has a smaller, if you like, central fiber, or thought of as in terms of orbits of an S1. The S1 orbits nearby all go once around the circle, but on that central fiber, the S1 orbit goes n times around the circle. I could put a K here also. Sorry, I should put a K. In the classical definition of fibration, it was supposed to always be locally trivial. It doesn't quite meet that, but it meets this sort of close relative of the classical description of fibration. So six of the geometries have these Seifert fibrations, and what do they look like? Well, they can be classified by the topological class of the circle bundle. And by chi, which is the Euler number of the base. And the possibilities look like this. I can either have E non-zero or E zero, and then I can have chi negative, chi equals zero, or chi positive. So the E equals zero cases are, maybe I should have put that column first. Let's match the exposition I'm following. The E equals zero cases are the easy ones. I have no topology in my circle bundle, and so I take what I use to describe the geometries in dimension two, and I just cross them with the real line, which is going to wrap up into a circle when I take compact quotients. So R2 becomes R3, and this becomes the hyperbolic plane cross R. So metrically, what I mean is to take a flat flat metric on the R factor, and then the metric, the constant curvature metric that I had before in the surface case. Here, I have the Hopf vibration, S3 mapping to S2. That's a non-trivial circle bundle over S2. And by the way, you can get all the other non-trivial topological classes by taking quotients. So an analog of this type of quotient can be done over an S2 base, where I just take the S1 action to be translation by a point of order n along the fiber, and then when I take the quotient, I get n times the original class. So the fixed point free quotients of S3, the so-called spherical space forms, give me lots of interesting topological classes, but geometrically it's only the S3. So that's S3 with its round metric. Here I have a geometry that Thurston called nil, and here I have SL2R universal cover. So the universal cover of SL2R is a simply connected three manifold with that group. I mean, it is a group, so that group is acting on it, and that's an example of a geometry which turns out to fall in this category. So six out of the eight I can just remember by that little table. Two of the geometries have T2 vibrations. Well, these are going to be T2 vibrations over a one-dimensional object, and that one-dimensional object might be a circle or it might be an interval, and if it's an interval, I have to worry about what it means at the endpoints. So that's why I put vibrations in quotes. One of those I've already seen is R3, and is nil. And the other one is a geometry that Thurston called Sol. So nil is appearing twice. It necessarily has a Seifert S1 vibration, and it also necessarily has a T2 vibration. The R3 geometries may have T2 vibrations, but they don't have to have T2 vibrations, so it doesn't quite go in that class. So I'm up to 7, and what's the 8th is hyperbolic space. So, in fact, 3 have constant curvature. And they're the strict analogs of the surface cases. So they're S3, R3, and H3. And those three had been extensively studied before Thurston's discussion. The rest had not been studied so systematically, although Seifert had studied the structure of Seifert fibrations. Seifert and others, Seifert's work was in the 20s, I think, had studied Seifert fibrations extensively over the intervening period of time. It's still a bit of a zoo, right? I mean, we've got hyperbolic three space, we've got all these six guys, we've got this other geometry called Sol, which has T2 vibrations instead of T1 vibrations. It's a bit of a zoo.
And when you say constant curvature, you mean constant all curvature?
Yeah. All the sectional curvatures are constant.
I have a question about those names, Lil and Sol.
Yeah.
Why do you pick those?
Because the corresponding Lie algebras are nilpotent and solvable, respectively. So one of them is the Daryl, help.
The Heisenberg.
The Heisenberg, yeah, but that's nil, right?
That's nil. Yeah.
That's nil. And what's Sol?
2 by 2 upper triangular.
2 by 2 upper triangular.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, complex, or something.
Just X, Y, 0, Z.
X, Y, 0, Z? Okay. Oh, that's, yeah, three-dimensional. How about that?
Thank you.
Sure. So, I'm going to very quickly tell you what's supposed to happen with Ricci flow on three manifolds. But then I think I'm going to give a continuation of this next week, in which I'll say that more slowly.
These eight manifolds are all, I mean, everything is in the order of these, or what's
I haven't told you that yet. Right. There are these eight things. So if I wanted something that was that had a geometric structure, which was an analog of what happened for all compact manifolds in dimension 2, I would have these eight choices.
How do you prove they're the only ones? And what kind of thing do you prove?
Well, you need a simply connected three manifold with a transitive isometry group, and Lie groups are classified, and representations are classified. I mean, I don't know if there's any slick proof, but
there are more than these, but eight suffice.
There are more than these, but eight suffice. What does that mean?
Well, there are other Lie groups that are homogeneous that don't admit compact quotients, and there are other Lie groups with compact quotients, but every manifold that has a compact, every Lie group that has a compact quotient, there's another Lie group of one of these types that has a compact quotient, so eight suffice. And you can do silly things like change structure constants.
I see. I mean, the formulation I used of calling it the isometry group of X, shouldn't that,
no, that
uniquely set?
Eight suffice.
Okay. Part of the reason for having this seminar is that we've got several groups of people who are expert in different parts of this story in the room. And so I'm drawing on one of them today, but that doesn't mean... what I'm hoping is that once we kind of see the big picture, we'll have more of a discussion than lecture at each other, but it's going to take a while before we see the big picture. Okay, so what is the kind of outcome of the Ricci flow program at the moment? You start with M and GIJ. M is compact and of dimension 3. And you let the gradient flow commence. Let's see. So just as in dimension 2, a 3-sphere will shrink to 0 in finite time. So S3 goes to a point in finite time. That's one of the things which can happen. A related thing which can happen, but something which is definitely new in this dimension, is that a region can form which has a very thin neck, and in finite time, the neck goes to zero, or the neck pinches off. Again, in finite time. So this is an S2 cross section. It's an S2 cross an interval. And a topologist, when looking at S2 cross an interval, will immediately tell you what to do with it. S2 cross an interval has as its boundary, that interval, by the way, is a one disk, right? So S2 cross an interval has as its boundary S2 cross S0. The zero sphere, for those who are unfamiliar with the notion, is the boundary of a one disk, an interval, so it's two points. And that's equally well the boundary of a three disk, three ball, cross the zero sphere. So if I've got two three balls inside of a three manifold, I can cut out those three balls, so these are bounded by two spheres, and I can take, with the same boundary, a two-sphere cross an interval and glue the things together. And what the neck pinching is doing is the opposite. So the neck pinching naturally through Ricci flow or gradient flow, this kind of neck is developing. It's pinching off. And what Perelman, based on suggestions of Hamilton, tells us to do is to, before that happens, cut out that part, replace it with some nice caps over here, and let the Ricci flow continue. And he shows that there is a natural way in which the Ricci flow before doing that cutting out and the Ricci flow after doing the cutting out are continuations of each other. So one of the interesting tasks to discuss with the physicists in the room is going to be, in both of these cases, what is the physical meaning if one is doing renormalization? What does it mean that the S3 went to a point in finite time? What does it mean that the neck pinched off in finite time and the surgery process allows the renormalization to continue? So either this process may or may not disconnect the original three manifold. One of the possibilities is that after doing this cutting, I actually have two three manifolds instead of a single one. Another possibility is that, you know, you had the main three manifold out here and then it had a long arm like this, right, which has acquired that neck, and by cutting along that guy, I didn't disconnect it, I just made it a little simpler. But there are these two kinds of singularities which can happen in finite time, and one of Perelman's big theorems is that these are the only two things that can happen in finite time. Moreover, the time locations at which they happen are discrete. So there are no accumulation points on the times at which you have to do these pinchings, the surgery for the pinching, or at which you see a three-sphere or one of its quotients. I should have said S3 mod gamma. A three-sphere going to zero in finite time. Oh, there's a hypothesis that I almost forgot to say. It's not completely clear what the role of this hypothesis is, but it plays an important part in the particularly in the Morgan-Tion exposition of Perelman's work, and the hypothesis is no embedded RP2s.
Is it clear you have to do a finite number of surgeries in a combat case? Able to finite number of surgeries?
Wouldn't it be nice if that were true? I think a lot of people believe that to be true, but that's not actually proved at the moment. So,
are you saying that you have to assume that there's no embedded RP2s in order for this whole story to work? That's the state of the art or something?
No, I mean, I think you can, I think they need that for the proof of Poincaré, but you can, you know, there are techniques for it.
Yeah, I think that it may be that if you don't make that assumption that the list of singularities is longer, I'm not completely sure what the status of that is. As I've tried to say, and in spite of the tone of voice with which I'm lecturing, I'm not an expert on this subject. Mike, maybe you know.
Comment about embedded RPQs. If we're assuming the three networks oriented, which I assume we are, then the embedded RP2 necessarily has a twisted normal bundle. And the boundary of that twisted normal bundle is just a two-sphere. So in terms of topological applications, if there's an embedded RP2, it means that the manifold you're discussing is a connected sum with some simpler manifold and RP3.
Right.
So if you're interested in the topological implications of all this, you can just split them off at the beginning.
Right. There are a lot of kind of simplifications which people tend to do when they're trying to get their hands on what the topological implications are. Partly because of the connection to renormalization, I would like to understand what happens if you start with an arbitrary metric and flow. And for the moment, at least with the stuff I'm reading, I ought to put in this hypothesis to begin with, and we can worry in a bit. We can collectively worry maybe about what it means or what changes it would.
So, what scale do you do the surgery? I mean, you just stop it at some.
Well, to make sure that everything is working properly and there aren't any accumulation points and stuff like that, Perlman has to make careful estimates about how close to the extinction time he makes the surgery and how much curvature he has to put into the caps and things of that sort. So there are lots of technical issues, and as a result, I cannot answer the question personally.
As you know, the sigma models will do that surgery naturally, but they also don't preserve topology generally. So if you just let a sigma model go, it might change the topology in a way you didn't want.
That's right. So, it's a little bit related to a discussion that you missed yesterday, which was after Matt's talk. But there's a trade-off here between when quantum effects in the sigma model will play a role as opposed to when this kind of classical surgery process is controlling the situation. And I don't think anybody's analyzed that yet. So we don't know whether this is going to exactly be mimicked properly in the field theory or whether there's some other effect that comes from quantum stuff that is not being considered in this analysis. The other comment, so most of the physicists in the room were in a discussion yesterday after a physics talk, and the other comment which came out of that comment that Matt Hedrick made is that in this case, well, ignore the gamma for a second. In this case, we essentially have, for a sphere shrinking in finite time, we essentially have an ON model, which we understand is going to form a mass gap. So the physical interpretation of this extinction is that the mass gap forms and that the physics makes sense, continues to make sense. Right. That's right.
Sorry, can there be accumulation points at time goes to infinity?
That has not been ruled out. So these surgeries, which correct for this thing, and extinctions happen at a discrete set of times. Discrete set of evolution times. T1, T2, T3. But it's not known if the number is finite. Now, what has been shown is that after a certain point, so for T large, the only thing that happens is a neck develops, pinches off, and what it leaves behind is an S3. So this caps off. Here you have an S3. And then this S3, a little bit later, shrinks to nothing. So there's no change in the topology for these later things. But I'm sort of imagining this like, you know, a bazooka that somebody keeps firing, right? You keep shooting out these two spheres which extinguish, and shooting them out and extinguishing. And I have no idea. I mean, nobody apparently at the moment has any idea whether that process stops or not. So it may just shoot off S3s forever. I don't know. It doesn't really seem like we want that to happen, but that's I think that hasn't been excluded. So other than these surgeries, what happens? So, by the way, these surgeries are happening. So, these are decomposing the three manifold along certain pieces, which have been known for a long time in topology. So, it was learned years ago. I don't know the history. I don't know whose name is associated with it. That you could cut the three manifold along these two spheres and end up with so-called prime sumands. There's a unique decomposition of any compact three manifold into these prime sumands by cutting in this way, and that cutting is being implemented here by the finite time singularities in the Ricci flow, in addition to potentially cutting off a bunch of three spheres which extinguish as time goes on. That has no effect on the topology. Pardon? Are there infinitely many primes? Yes. In fact, primes, well, yes. So that stuff is going on. But what else is happening? The other thing that's happening is that the three manifold is dividing itself into a bunch of regions. And in those regions, the volume of the three manifold is either staying constant or growing, but the regions are connected by various tubes, and it's even possible, I think, for there to be more than one tube connecting a pair of regions. I'm not completely sure about that, but I'll draw it that way anyway. So the regions are connected by these tubes, and each of these regions is geometric. Well, it's geometric as t goes to infinity. Let me put that in quotes because I have to qualify it in a second. And what do the tubes look like? The tubes essentially look like an interval across a two torus. Well, metrically, they're not quite like that. So metrically, what's happening is that from the geometric region is emanating a tube across a two torus. And as you go out further and further, and as you evolve closer and closer to the geometric structure, the tubes get narrower as you go out. So in the limit, the tube becomes infinitely long. And viewed from the perspective of either of these geometric pieces, it sort of approaches a point. This is some limiting process, right? But never mind that the volume of the whole thing that it's a limit of has also become infinite. So there are various kinds of scalings that you could imagine doing to try to get your hands on what was going on. One is to rescale the volume of a piece to be zero, in which case the T2 cross-section of the end is going to go to zero size. Another would be to rescale so that the you continue to see those T2s, then this interval that it's part of is going to go to infinite size. So sort of sitting there, everything else recedes out into the background. But that's the basic picture, is that it divides into these pieces. And the one caveat is that if the geometric piece is not a hyperbolic three manifold, H3 mod gamma, then it collapses along an S1, T2, or T3 vibration. Now, the one kind of lack in this story, from my perspective, is that that collapsing process, it's a Gromov-type collapsing process, and there's no control over any geometric structure on the parameter space for the vibration. So in these cases, the S1 and the T2 cases, particularly the S1 case, you expect that to be an S1 over a surface, and you would hope that the geometry of the three manifold, which kind of reflected a combination of the geometry of that surface, the geometric constant curvature metric on that surface, together with an appropriate metric on the total space of the circle bundle, you would hope that that would show up in the t goes to infinity limit, and the techniques of Perelman and his successors have not yielded any information about that. So it'd be sort of nice to believe that in the end, if you scaled properly, you would be able to recover the constant curvature metric on the surface that was parameterizing those S1s. But at the moment, we can't do that.
What are those 2 second cases? I don't understand those. What do you mean, T2 vibration?
Sorry. T2 vibration or T3 mod gamma, if you like. Sorry.
Even T2 vibration.
Right, so that was the nil and salt cases. I mean, the point is, in the nil case, the surface that you map to...
There's no tube in that case, is that correct? That's sort of the case by itself. It's not one of these pieces with tubes coming in, I think. I mean, there's a sort of closed situation that can happen, but...
I guess that's right. There's no tube in this case. That's right. Yeah.
What do you mean by that? It can't be one of these blobs?
It can't. That's right. It can't connect to other kinds of blobs. That's right. So the T2 and probably the T3 this may apply to as well,
right.
As well as the S3 with the spherical space forms, all those guys are kind of isolated. But what could happen, since I disconnected the manifold, I could have some of those as islands in this thing. Right.
Yeah. So the case you drew certainly can't happen. You can have lots of these T2 tubes connecting to the same
manifold. Okay. Okay.
You're saying they were connected by S2 cross-section things before.
So Mike has just convinced me that it's really got to be the ciphered fibered case only here, and that the T2 fiber and T3 cases are separate and don't connect to the other ones.
But they could have connected by...
What will happen if you have one of these pieces is that it has an S1 vibration and that S1 collapses down to the base. So I end up finding two-dimensional components in the limit, right? And in fact, the arms coming out of the two-dimensional components are the usual things that you expect to see as a metric on a punctured Riemann surface, that those punctures have gone out towards infinity. That's how it connects in to something that may be coming from a hyperbolic manifold.
I think as far as we know, that you can have a tube coming back to the same piece.
Yeah, sure. Sorry. I could have done that too. So I'll just close by explaining a couple of the ways in which this picture, which is the picture that Dennis Sullivan gave a bunch of us at Stony Brook in August, is kind of suggestive. One of the things that makes string theory go is exactly this kind of decomposition in the case of two dimensions. So in the case of two dimensions, string theorists are used to taking field theory pictures in which you imagine particles kind of coming and interacting and then shooting off their components, their output, of which this is a simple example, and turning those into two-dimensional versions of the same kind of interaction diagram where you have some internal region where the interaction is happening and then legs coming out which indicate the input and output of the physical process. That kind of looks like the same thing is going on here. In fact, if we had a version of Perelman's theorem, not just for compact three manifolds, but for three manifolds with boundary in which the asymptotics near the boundary was somehow related to what you're expecting to see from hyperbolic quotients. So if you had some inputs and outputs in this picture, then you would be seeing a similar kind of picture for three manifolds. Moreover, a number of the pieces in the intermediate story, according to the Ricci flow, if you were to run Ricci flow forever, would collapse down to surfaces. So they collapse along circle bundles, and what's really suggestive about that to people who've been looking at string theory, and in particular M theory over the last 10 years, is that the string theory, which was based on the study of these two-dimensional quantum field theories, is believed to have a limit at so-called strong string coupling in which the string becomes a three-manifold via some circle bundle over that 3 manifold. So here we're getting a mixture between 3 manifolds that had that property and other 3 manifolds, the hyperbolic pieces, that didn't have that property but still represent some kind of interactions. It's also known through lots of examples that M theory, this bigger theory, is actually richer than just the strong coupling limit of the string theory. So, you know, it's kind of suggestive to me that there may be some approach to a fundamental formulation of M theory based on our now modern understanding of the structure of 3 manifolds. Since the Ricci flow that's involved in determining that structure is closely related to the two-dimensional field theories, it's suggestive that perhaps there will be some kind of string theory on the 3 manifold whose the outputs of which will be assembled together to form the something like a perturbative M theory expansion, although I have no idea how to assemble everything together, just as the field theory on a surface was assembled together to form the perturbative version of a string theory expansion. So I was going to close there, but Steve has a question.
Well, I was just going to say, so you told us that the general geometry is things that look like this and then sewn together with these throats with S2 cross-sections.
T2 cross-sections.
No, the S2 guys, too.
The S2 guys pinched off and went away.
Okay,
but in the infrared, there won't be any S2s left over.
Not in the infrared, but if you're talking about the sort of summing over the general set of surfaces, you include those too, right?
So let me say one more thing about what this suggested to me and Martin Rocek as we were discussing it this summer. So here, there are kind of 2 steps, right? If you're doing the path integral over all surfaces, then you have a step where you have to worry about the conformal class of the metric. And there's a standard maneuver, introduction of ghost fields and performing some Gaussian-type integrals, which reduces everything to then integrating over some finite-dimensional spaces, the moduli, to do the computation. So here I'm, one of the reasons that I told you about Hamilton's theory for surfaces was to show you that the conformal class was really taken care of by that procedure. So here what I'm kind of hoping is that it's the conformal, that the endpoint of Ricci flow is telling us the stuff that we need to do. In fact, the endpoint of Ricci flow, these hyperbolic pieces don't have moduli, the surface pieces still have finite moduli, there's some finite dimensional integral to do potentially if you've got insertions. So you could imagine that the Ricci flow is kind of telling you how to do that integral, and those are the things which you put together.
So you might have naively thought that the other things corresponded to propagators where you had, in comparing with this picture, the string picture, where you
right.
had sort of S2 membranes propagating.
Those go away somehow. Those all go away, and what I'm left with, by the way, in the surface case, a point insertion really became an insertion along a circle, right? There are a lot of operators which you can specify something about the boundary conditions around that circle, and the initial propagation sort of is. It's just including that circular cross section. And now if I lift that to M theory, then that surface in M theory really does become a one parameter family of T2s, because I had to have a circle bundle over a circle. So although it sounds like I've really restricted generality in terms of the propagators that are going only along things with T2 cross sections, it seems to me that it is possibly rich enough to do what we want. Yes.
I mean, one difference might be, though, that there was a small coupling constant, whereas in M theory, the only small parameter is the energy, if you like,
right.
over the point
right.
yeah, scale. So membranes are
another really interesting difference is that over there, it was just the genus which classified what the pieces would look like, and that everything could be talked about in terms of that one discrete parameter. And here, you know, the classification of finite co-volume or co-compact subgroups of H3 is horrendous. Is that a good word? there are lots of them. There are lots of them, and I don't really know what the current state of the art is, but 20 years ago, there wasn't a lot of structure to the set of groups. Maybe there is now. I have no idea. Okay. So we have a lot of interesting things to sum over, and we don't understand how to organize them or control them at the moment. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that at low energies, there's a small parameter, which is the energy. You can do perturbation from
right.
that to some extent. But then you don't see any of the structure. It's just
right.
theory. And once you do see the structure, is there a small parameter that governs this, you know, the
right.
While
I'm chatting with Eva, let me just mention to the room that there are other potential physical applications, including one that Eva is very interested in directly studying the two-dimensional theory with target spaces like three manifolds, and I think that will be worth discussing as well. So the plan is to continue these introductory lectures for a little while. I guess I've got another lecture in me. Daryl has kindly agreed to introduce Thurston's program to us. You remember volunteering to do that? and those things should hold us for a couple of weeks, and I'm hoping that there will be a lot of discussion. It's hard to have a lot of discussion if the room is so full, but I would encourage everybody in the back to jump into the discussion in future meetings. I'll stop there.
Thank you.